No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And if you have a question, you can call in at 888-627-6008. Tonight we have, in addition to having Marilia with us tonight, we have a very special guest, Dr. Bandy Lee. Dr. Lee is a medical school doctor, a forensic psychiatrist, and a world expert on violence who taught at Yale Medical School and Yale Law School for 17 years before transferring recently to Columbia and Harvard. She became known to the public by leading a group of mental health professionals and colleagues in breaking the silence about the immediate past U.S. president, and wrote a best-selling book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, with 37 psychiatrists and mental health experts assessing the president. So, Dr. Lee, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, you and these medical professionals have assessed them. So, go ahead, doctor. What's your assessment?
Well, we always considered Donald Trump not just to be an individual matter, but actually a public health problem that would become dangerous for the nation. And that's why many of us who had never spoken in public about these issues before gathered together to first do a conference at Yale School of Medicine, where I was faculty at the time, and then a few months later to publish the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, as you said. We thought of it as part of our societal responsibility. Our ethics guidelines say we have a societal responsibility as well as to our patients. So that's what we did. And within 3 months of our publication, we became the number one topic of national conversation. I was invited to speak with over 50 Congress members, and we were hoping at that time that something would happen, but we are where we are today instead.
I assume that those 60 members of Congress were all Democrats? Is that true?
Yes, except for one member, and that one member, I think, wasn't quite expecting to be speaking with us, and then very, very briefly spoke with us, and then proceeded to depart.
Well, before I let my co-host ask some brilliant question, which is why I have her on the show, I want to ask you something. My brother was a psychologist and a counselor, college counselor. And I talked to him when Donald Trump first got elected. And I said, well, he's certainly a narcissist. And my brother said, no, he's something much deeper and darker than a narcissist. Is that true? And what would that be?
You know, yes, excellent. That shows your brother's training and clinical insight. Our concern mainly was that people were not recognizing the grave impairment that Donald Trump had and saw him as simply a different kind of politician or eccentric personality that was within the range of normalcy. But of course, those of us who have experience otherwise, treating grave disorders day in and day out, recognize that he was something much more dangerous for the nation, that he probably had not just one disorder, but a good dozen disorders that would greatly imperil the nation. Although we didn't diagnose and we wouldn't diagnose someone we haven't examined, that was not the issue. His danger to the public and his unfitness for office were the issues.
Marilia, do you have something you want to add?
Yes. So let me just say kamsahamnida to you, Dr. Lee, for all the service you're providing society and the world of politics.
I did not realize you spoke Korean.
No, I don't. I've been to Korea. I've been with a lot of Koreans, and that word is one of the few I know. So that's, but thank you. And you have a lovely culture in your country. You're welcome. Let me ask you, many things to say. The first I will say, back in April of 2016, my father's was a psychiatrist, I should say, and I did undergraduate and graduate work in the biological sciences, and then I studied neuroscience, and I used to write neuroscience for The Economist. so I don't come out of thin air with my thoughts on this. And back in April of 2016, excuse me, I wrote a piece. I was so bewildered and just staggered by watching the rise of Donald Trump and what seemed to be at the time was a non-stoppable trajectory. And I couldn't stand the fact that no one was addressing the elephant in the room, which was his mental state. With my background, I could see it, you don't need to be a full-fledged psychiatrist, I think, to notice that his behavior was not the norm, and certainly not the norm to hold office.
And so I
wrote this piece, and I couldn't get it published because no one would go against Donald Trump. And I finally did get it published, and I co-wrote it with the psychologist who, in point of fact, decided against having his name on the piece in the end, which speaks to one point, and that is the fear of crossing that line, the Goldwater Rule. And there was one exception, which was the Congressman Norm Mineta, who was a wonderful and rare, humble human being who took my article and put it in his suit pocket so he could share it with everybody. But beyond him, there was no one else, as you yourself know. So why do you think that nothing gets interpreted in the correct way, that nothing happens, that people just let all these people like Donald Trump, especially he's to me the antithesis, I mean the epitome of this. Why do you think that there is sort of this lack of awareness of how mental health plays into a leadership role?
Yes, I don't think it's a lack of awareness, because in the very beginning, in fact, I was very impressed with how much response there was. When I first held a conference, for example, from the inside, a lot of psychiatrists were actually fearful that Donald Trump, being as litigious as he was, would come for their licenses or his violence-prone followers would attack them or their families. So there was fear as a result of knowing about his dangerousness, but there was no doubt about his dangerousness. And in fact, there was a medical consensus among us. The only difference was, as you mentioned, the Goldwater Rule which was actually considered so insignificant that it was never taught in any psychiatry residency program that we are aware of, and in fact was considered obsolete already when it was entered into the books in 1973. Mm. And of course, since the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual stopped relying on personal interviews for diagnosis since 1980, it also couldn't really apply in the way that it's interpreted for the public. But what mm-hmm. the American Psychiatric Association did with Donald Trump's inauguration was that it came out and entirely reinterpreted the rule. First of all, most psychiatrists didn't even hear about the rule before the APA came out emphasizing it, and made it more important than all the other sacred tenets of medical ethics, including our responsibility to society. So that's mm-hmm. actually what alarmed me more than anything else. And I realized that in authoritarian times, the first to be silenced are journalists and intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And the intellectuals of relevance here were the psychiatrists and psychologists and anyone who is familiar with mental disorders, because only after one has familiarized oneself with the level of this kind of impairment and knows how to deal with such individuals would there be an appropriate response. Certainly, all the more so if the condition is bad enough that the lay public is recognizing it. And in fact, the reception of our book itself spoke volumes in that we were a multi-authored, specialized group publishing this book, and it became an instant New York Times bestseller. There's no such book in memory, actually, of such a book becoming a New York Times bestseller. And mm-hmm. even though we were published by one of the big five publishers of the country, they were not prepared for that level of popularity. It took them 5 weeks to catch up with the demand. Every wow. outlet was instantly sold out. So they had to stock Amazon, the bookstores, over and over, and yet they were instantly sold out, were sold out within an hour, that it took them 5 weeks to catch up. So it's not a lack of awareness, in my opinion, but I think we were rather targeted and silenced once we mm-hmm. decided to speak out.
Mm-hmm. What do you think needs to be done? Because there seems to be, and congratulations, by the way, it's really a big achievement on your part and your colleagues, but there seems to be a chasm between the diagnosis and sort of the manifestation of the diagnosis in terms of the brain's behavior, in terms specifically of what people can imagine that he would do as a result of his mental illness, or however you want to state it.
Yes.
And do you think we need to educate the public more on that and cite specific and solid and concrete examples? It just seems to me that people can't connect those dots between the brain and its product.
Yes, I again would say it's not so much the public, because we continued, ever since I had held the conference and came out with the book, thousands of mental health professionals joined us, and we formed the World Mental Health Coalition. People can learn about it through my website, bandylee.com. Mm-hmm. The World Mental Health Coalition continued to try to educate the public, but I think, and the public continued to contact us and demanded our participation. They said, where are the psychiatrists? Where are the psychologists? That was what we were hearing constantly from the public. But what happened was, after those 3 months of our rising to the number one topic of national conversation, and I was interviewing 15 hours a day. Every single day, I was invited to all the major network and cable news programs. Mm-hmm. There was not one major program I was not invited to. Mm-hmm. And then within weeks of the American Psychiatric Association coming out with partnering with the New York Times, denouncing us as being unethical for breaking the Goldwater Rule, and that's how the public came to know about the rule that not even psychiatrists used to know about. Months prior to that, that everyone started citing the Goldwater Rule and would not have us on the news programs. Actually, there's history to the Goldwater Rule, which is tied to politics, as the name itself suggests. Every other psychiatric ethical rule, or there are more guidelines than rules, there are no rules, guidelines are based on scholarship and clinical experience, not based on politics. But this is the one rule that was politically pressured, and that's why it's actually a superfluous rule. You don't diagnose anybody unless you've done an examination. But but the point is, when a public figure is involved who is not a patient, what's important is not the diagnosis, but what, again, as I said before, whether they are a danger to the public or if they are unfit for office. That is what is of public interest. That's not a diagnostic test, but it is a mental health test. And we do it all the time, routinely, for employers, for potential bodies that could be placed in danger. Every military officer has to undergo a fitness test before they even assume office, before they assume their post. And yet the commander of the military does not require it. It's actually a glaring omission that the highest office of the land is the only office that doesn't require the person to be fit to hold the office.
Exactly. So, and he's got his finger on the nuclear button.
Exactly. Exactly. And those who carry out nuclear commands have to pass rigorous psychological tests every year.
Let me ask you, Dr. Lee, because I've been in politics for 40 years and I never heard of the Goldwater Rule. What exactly is a Goldwater Rule that you cannot assess, you cannot make an assessment of a publicly elected official and publish that? Is that what they... basically what the rule says, and how did it come to be?
The rule came to be in 1964 when Barry Goldwater was running for president, the presidency, and there was a tabloid magazine called Fact, which decided to survey all the members of the American Psychiatric Association. In other words, with the question, is Barry Goldwater something mentally wrong with him? And actually, it shouldn't have been even an issue because less than 10% responded saying inappropriately that he met all kinds of diagnoses and that he was a latent homosexual and all kinds of things you cannot assess. It was just 10%. The rest either responded responsibly or didn't respond at all. But the magazine chose to sensationalize it and said, over 1,000 psychiatrists say Barry Goldwater is unfit, mentally unfit. Well, Lyndon Johnson won by a landslide, and Barry Goldwater decided to sue the magazine, and he won. It caused the magazine to go bankrupt. He earned a penny, I think. And after that, the American Psychiatric Association was embarrassed, but it was the very political American Medical Association, in fact, which was largely Republican, that pressured the APA into putting it into its ethics guidelines. So the APA relented, and when it wrote its new guidelines in 1973, it included what should be matter of fact. It said, but actually, the only reason it was able to enter in the ethics guidelines in the first place was because it was purporting to be good for public health. So it said, so psychiatrists are required to participate in activities that better the community and improve public health. That was the guideline. But if you're asked about a public figure, educate the public, except just don't diagnose. That was the original Goldwater rule. Mm-hmm. But of course, over time, it became irrelevant because not needing to diagnose was not so essential anymore. With all the media exposure that individuals have and even the diagnostic criteria becoming objective observation rather than subjective interviews, it became irrelevant that you couldn't even diagnose either. Not diagnosing also did not become relevant. So people just forgot about the Goldwater rule. It was probably not even eliminated because no one cared about it. But with the campaign and election of Donald Trump, the American Psychiatric Association suddenly came forth and said the Goldwater rule is not just about not diagnosing a public figure, but not commenting on any aspect of them at all, even objectively observable behavior. That doesn't make any sense. And in fact, ethicists who specialize in the Goldwater rule themselves came out and said that doesn't make any sense and that is incorrect. But the APA wasn't interested in the truth, it turns out. They were interested in leading public disinformation, because once they came out with a statement that any comment on any of any kind about a public figure counts as being unethical, that actually goes against our ethics guidelines and the core principles of psychiatric ethics, because we're supposed to participate, as I said before, to improve the community and better public health, and to participate in our responsibility to society in addition to our responsibility to patients. So, and not only that, there's also the Geneva Declaration, which is not just an APA guideline. The APA is only one of numerous mental health associations, by the way, and it's not national despite its name. It's more like a trade association. And but the World Psychiatric, the World Medical Association had put out the Geneva Declaration 1948, which was essentially that physicians and medical professionals had an obligation to speak up if a dangerous regime is undermining the welfare of humanity. And this came out of the experience of Nazism. So it's actually specifically coming out of the experience of medical professionals either participating or not speaking up against a dangerous regime. So we were now in an era where that same rule applied. And of course, the Geneva Declaration overrides any small APA guideline, which was not supposed to be there in the first place, and no other mental health association adopted the same rule. Not even licensing boards can, because it actually goes against the First Amendment. And in fact, diagnosing a public figure should not really be singled out. You simply don't diagnose anybody you haven't examined and gotten consent from. That's diagnosing is for individual treatment. What's of relevance to the public is dangerousness and unfitness. And that's what they blocked against psychiatrists' obligation to society and our duty according to all the tenets of medical ethics.
Well, I think I know the answer to the next question, doctor, but let me ask it anyway. I assume in your opinion and the opinion of the doctors that helped and medical professionals that helped write your book, Donald Trump is not fit for to be president, not fit for public office?
Yes, that's the first thing we were concerned about, because dangerousness actually is, you don't need a diagnosis for dangerousness. And dangerousness assessments are done every single encounter, whether it's someone you're an office visit for the first time in the emergency room. Dangerousness is the first thing you assess, and you intervene before you do a full assessment. And someone who's dangerous is by definition unfit. So we need not even go further. There was enough information of his dangerousness to deem him unfit. But actually, in addition to that, we did do a fitness test of him when the Mueller report came out. It was the exact kind of information we would use for fitness tests. And fitness tests, of course, are done without needing consent. It's not the person, not the individual who requests it, but either the employer or, which in this case is the public, in the case of a president. Since we were getting so many messages from the public, we decided that we would respond to the public's request now that we had the information of the reports by coworkers and close associates under sworn testimony. So this is far better information than we ordinarily get for fitness tests. And we did a full assessment. We assembled a panel of national experts of renowned stature and carried out the fitness test. He failed every single criterion, which means, and this is a basic mental fitness test, so it means that he's not just unfit for the presidency, he's unfit for any job whatsoever.
That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing to me. I want to ask you, you wrote an article for Scientific America. You co-wrote an article about our shared psychosis with Donald Trump and how we wean people off it. As a politician that cares deeply about America, which obviously you care as well, Doctor, how do we wean? Because I find this crazy. I find this crazy that I talk to Trump people all the time and they say, yeah, we know he's crazy. Yeah, we know he's this. Yeah, we know he's that. But we're going to vote for him anyway. That I just don't understand. I don't understand that. Can you explain why people are drawn to this and why they seem to accept I don't know that they accept everything you're saying, but certainly many of them accept that he's off the rails, but they don't care.
Yes, that not caring and that inability to have ordinary, rational decision making supersede their fealty to him is the kind of spread of shared psychosis that I was warning against. That if you have a severely mentally impaired person in such an influential office with constant exposure to the public, then there are certain symptoms that spread. And those would be the kinds of symptoms that Donald Trump has, such as proneness to paranoia, to delusions, and to violent responses. These are all symptoms that have a tendency to spread. Now, we don't often think of mental symptoms as spreading, we don't think of mental disorder as being infectious. But in fact, they can be far more contagious than ordinary infectious disease because they do not require physical exposure to spread. You, of course, need the right conditions. And in today's environment of mass media, social media going viral, and people being pulled by the emotional bonds they form with politicians from afar, it's in fact the very environment through which symptoms would spread. So I would say that the contagious aspects of mental symptoms are far more dangerous. And well, shared psychosis is a well-known phenomenon that's been documented and studied for the last 150 years. It's been called different things, but we know when it happens. I've seen it actually quite frequently because I worked in public sector settings for state hospitals or in state clinics and prisons where mental disorders commonly go untreated until they're very severe. What happens is that, be it in a family or in a gang or in prison blocks, it's not the healthy individuals who bring around the one with the severe symptoms. It's this, the one who is severely ill who spreads their symptoms in a way that the those who are previously healthy come to look as if they have the same disorder. In fact, it's often very difficult to tell who has the primary disorder. It you decipher it by history. But the interesting thing is once you remove that individual and hospitalize them, treat them, and separate them from the others who are affected, the others return to normal or their pre-exposure state. And that can be very dramatic. So that's what I've been advocating, that those who have been exposed and those who are following Donald Trump, you can tell it's not a rational response. They will follow him to their death, and many literally have during the COVID pandemic. And there's nothing that will change their minds, including 4 indictments and 91 charges.
Right.
Criminal indictment, none of this seems to sway these individuals, and that's because the emotional compulsion to follow him is far stronger than any rational persuasion. And this is actually a characteristic we see with mental disease. I often say that fascism is not a political ideology, but mm-hmm. mental pathology in politics, because we see the exact characteristics of mental disorder and mental pathology in the political body, as we see in individual patients in under ordinary circumstances. So that's why it was incumbent on those with the expertise to educate the public and to allow the healthy segment of the population to be able to intervene. And that's what we were trying to do, and we're hopeful we were making progress on when we were speaking with all the Congress members who were championing our cause. But because of the American Psychiatric Association's disinformation campaign, which was very effective when an authoritative large organization portends to speak for the profession but shuts down all the individual professionals who were trying to speak and act on their conscience. So after that, none of the news organizations felt comfortable having us on, and within 2 or 3 weeks, we were shut out of all media.
So let me just ask you, before I let Maroli ask you another question, how do we wean people off this? Is there a way do we need to change our politics to change this, or is there some other way? I mean, how exactly do we wean people away from? If you've got 91 criminal indictments and people don't care, what do we do to make people care?
Well, people would care, and many people have cared, but the media would not reflect the people's desire or answer the questions they demanded answers for. And once an establishment like the APA came forth, the media organizations stopped having us on. Every time I aired or published an article, it was the number one program. It was the number one publication. It was the number one article of that week, or it was always the most in demand. But news organizations, towing the line of what the establishment was telling them to do, and it turned out the APA was actually very federally driven, because they do get a lot of federal funding, and we don't know how they were pressured, but we do know that since shutting all of us down, they got windfalls of federal funding in unprecedented ways in their history, enough for them to move from Arlington, Virginia, to the center of Washington, D.C., in the trendiest of neighborhoods, shoulder to shoulder with Washington lobbyists now. That never happened before, and it only happened after they shut us down. So it's this kind of alignment to power rather than doing the duties of the profession, acting on the specialized knowledge that people had. And in ordinary life, we don't have a gastroenterologist do brain surgery. We don't have a plumber come and do intricate psychotherapy. So to leave out mental health experts is like leaving out infectious disease experts during the COVID pandemic. What happened was, in a nation of the most advanced medical systems and the greatest concentration of experts in the area, had the worst outcome during the COVID pandemic. The U.S. led the world in number of COVID deaths. And to the world's amazement and horror, and the same is happening in the public mental health crisis that we are living through right now. When we shun experts and don't heed the science and the best available knowledge that we have, especially in public health matters, then we're taking away the number one tool for dealing with the problem. And it would not be a surprise if we, even in this realm, fall into ignorance and self-destruction the same way we did with the COVID pandemic. We essentially experienced it like the Middle Ages. It became a plague rather than something that was sensibly dealt with based on science and public health knowledge. We're doing the same with the mental health crisis we're experiencing. And by mental health crisis, I mean the pathology that is plaguing the realm of politics. So I don't have an answer for you other than to employ the correct expert knowledge and make use of what we already know. That's what's not being done at the moment. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me, and it seems clear, that the P in APA doesn't stand for psychiatry or psychology. It stands for politics, and it's pretty abhorrent, and it's shocking, actually. And it seems to me that something drastic needs to be done about that, or else it's going to get worse. And I read somewhere that these statistics speak to the fact that the proportion of narcissists in society has increased over the recent decades, and part of that is attributed to social media. What do you think of that? And also, I would imagine that legislation, on a separate note, for, I guess, question number two for you, Dr. Lee, is this requirement that politicians get psychiatric evaluation be legislated? And if, you know, if the APA is really the American Politics Association, that's going to be very difficult. So take it away, please.
Yes, that's very clever. I might borrow that. I'll credit you, of course.
No, you don't have to.
Yes, of course, it was devastating for me as a psychiatric professional because I recognized mm-hmm. what was happening, that mm-hmm. a professional organization, instead of doing its societal duty, was exploiting its own knowledge of the field like an inside trader, like an insider trader, mm-hmm. To protect its own interests and not be not do anything that would be
not fulfill their mission
to the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
And so to answer your question, yes, I do believe that we are undergoing an incredible crisis of narcissism, and I would even take it further to say sociopathy mm-hmm. in the public sphere, because in my 25-year career of treating violent offenders as a specialty, as a forensic psychiatrist, I've worked mostly in prison settings, mm-hmm. to find the dangerous personality disorders increasingly outside the walls of jails and prisons, into corporate boardrooms, and now in politics, is an extremely, extremely
Absolutely.
Disturbing phenomenon. And, of course, we know that these disorders are never good for society. In fact,
Absolutely.
they drive us to destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, yes, indeed, it would be important to intervene with the conditions that gave rise to them in the first place. Part of it is social media. Of course, it stokes it to the point of threatening young people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the media in general that stoke narcissism and kind of the more mm-hmm. sometimes called primitive drives in people, which are more the realms of personality disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the deeper problem is socioeconomic inequality. Because when mm-hmm. there's a vast amount of inequality, or what I call structural violence, then it's not just deprivation that happens. It has a psychological effect, and people become much more vulnerable to demagogic leaders because they become more developmentally wounded or developmentally regressed, which means that we will see more narcissistic individuals, more psychopathic mm-hmm. individuals, and that certainly has an influence on culture and society if it's widespread. As for the psychological testing of elected officials, it's not that that's so exceptional. People often get alarmed at that idea, and they often also say that it would never happen, that it's unconstitutional. But I'm sure that if the founders of this nation were active today, they would see that the extraordinary exception of only elected officials not being required to be fit for office would be so extraordinary that they would never agree to it. Because the truth is, for every task and every job in the United States, fitness is required. Of course, fitness is assumed, but when you see signs of unfitness, then oftentimes you can suspend the person from a job or prevent a task from happening until they pass the fitness test. And for very important positions, and increasingly all chief executive officers even, are required to pass a fitness test before they assume office because of the importance of their mental stability and lack of dangerous characteristics. So the fact that we don't do this for the most important offices in the land is what's exceptional and extraordinary. And the reason why people who probably could not hold any other job elsewhere are all gathering in Congress and the presidency.
Let me ask you, since since my colleague here, Marilia, has brought this up, you know, Marilia served under two presidential administrations and worked with Congress, and I've been in politics 40 years. And what really struck me, Doctor, was a statement that I heard you make, that your mom wanted to come to the United States because of our historic ability to place principle over tribe.
Yes.
It seems to me that we're losing that. That, you know, when I was young, yes, you know, I'm 70 years old, but when I was growing up, yes, there was this sense of high ideals in America that superseded everything. It seems that we've lost that now, and that it's all about me winning over you. Do you think this is part of the national psychosis that you're talking about?
Yes, I would say that it's part of the regression. In fact, the U.S. was a beacon for the world, and my parents didn't miss that. They both came as students from South Korea, and my mother in particular was highly, she was heavily into Western philosophy, human rights, and democratic principles. And the idea of a nation being formed by those principles, the very laudable American experiment that is not dependent on tribal lineage or occupation of prior occupation of the land, but by participation in this democratic government, it was considered highly successful and a model for the world. I still believe it's successful. In fact, it's an it's a psychologically evolved state of culture or nation. It's when in a time of crisis and economic inequality that supersedes any democratic equality, that has eroded this this incredible accomplishment of governance, that we're actually seeing a regress state of people no longer being able to assemble around shared principles and a common agreement, but rather are resorting to nationalism, tribal superiority. That was the norm in many developing societies, but it wasn't always the norm in this society. In fact, it's so surprising that many of us, including myself, who grew up in this country, can no longer recognize the country I grew up in.
Mm-hmm. I share that with you, Dr. Lee, as an immigrant. Yeah.
And as a kid born in New Jersey, I share it with you, you know. And before I let my esteemed colleague ask the last question, because we're running out of time here, once again, Doctor, give the address of your website so that our listeners can follow you after this discussion.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that opportunity. It is bandylee.com. That's bandylee.com. You can follow me on Twitter through it. You can subscribe to my newsletter. You can also contact me, as well as look up my series of interviews and articles. And very shortly, I'll be posting this interview as well, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope you do. And I encourage people to read the book as well. You know, this is such an important thing for us, and we need to make the decision as individual voters next year. And I hope that it's all educated for all of us. It's an educated decision, and it's educated by work like you're doing, Doctor, so that we listen to the professionals when we make these decisions. And given that little plug for A Better America, Marilia Duffels, go ahead and ask the last question, and then we'll let the doctor go.
I just want to say, without sounding patronizing, just sheer congratulations to you and your colleagues for all the incredible work you've done. It's just so imperative that it keep progressing. So in that vein, what can we as citizens, or Mike and I, but what can we as citizens do to help you help the cause progress to the point where it needs to get?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to emphasize that as professionals, our obligation is really to the public. We don't have the special knowledge and privileges to simply to bolster our individual positions or to be elitist. Actually, we have an obligation to the public and a service to render to the public and to share our knowledge. And the ultimate goal is to elevate the voice of the public, that it's intended to empower the public, because knowledge is power, and knowledge is not to be kept in our private circles, but meant to be shared. And I would like to extend the credit to the public that we were simply responding to the public's voice and demand, myself included, when the morning after election, I was contacted by all manner of civil society members asking me to speak up based on my work on violence prevention, mostly in prisons, but that was what I was responding to. And if we listened to the public's voice, truly elevated the public's voice, no matter what field we're in, we would be in good shape.
Well, that's a perfect way to end it. And let me tell you, Doctor, your work in prisons may go on with the former president, as he may find himself there soon. but thank you so much for the work you're doing. This is so important for America. And I think that I speak for Marilia as well as myself when I tell you that we believe in this country. It's obvious mm-hmm. that you believe in this country. And together, hopefully, we can continue the great legacy of being a beacon to the world, that shining city on the hill that Ronald Reagan talked about. Thank you so much, Doctor. We hope to have you back on the show sometime, because this is a subject you obviously can't cover in 55 minutes. We leave each show with a song to leave our audience, you know, on a happier note, maybe. But tonight we do something we dedicate it to you, Doctor, and all the people out there that don't listen to you but excuse this kind of behavior. Here's one, a classic song from the late great Warren Zevon. Thank you so much, Doctor, for being on the show. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you once again. Oh, tamaneo.
Okay, thank you for my brilliant co-host for being on as well.
Thank you, Mike.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Give the people their right to vote.